There are only two types of movements in this world, historically looking. There are spontaneous movements and successful movements. In order to be successful, movements need to plan.
Welcome to a new episode of What is to be Done? In our show, we talk about political strategy and how to win.
We are Valentin and Inken, and as you can tell from our accents, we're both activists from Germany, and we use this podcast to discuss the pressing strategic questions in German movements.
We recorded this episode before the war in Ukraine had started, and back then we asked ourselves whether overthrowing dictators would actually be a relevant question to activists in Germany. Today, however, this question has become more pressing than ever, as the resistance in Russia against Putin and his war has become central for establishing peace.
Sergei Popovich is our guest today, and he's one of the best people to discuss these questions with. He comes from Serbia and was part of the resistance which overthrew dictator Milosevic back in the 1990s. Today, Sergei works as a trainer and consultant for activists all around the world.
In the interview, we now talk about his lessons learned from the Serbian resistance, the question of militancy in the climate movement, and the relationship between the climate crisis and dictatorships.
Thanks for listening. Hey, Sergei, very nice to have you on our show.
Hello. Great to be on your show. Greetings from sunny Colorado mountains.
Hi. Very nice. That's very nice to hear in cold Berlin, in cold Germany. Yeah, let's just start right into the interview. How did you start thinking about the question of nonviolent strategic activism?
Well, I wasn't thinking I was doing it. First of all, let me give you a little bit of a background. I was a student in Belgrade University in early 90s, when a pretty bad guy named Slobodan Milosevic came to power. And within the range of a few years, my world has fell apart. And not only mine, the country fell apart, part economy fell apart, the generation fell apart, perspectives fell apart. We ended up in a crazy nationalism led by three irresponsible national leaders, one from Serbia, one from Bosnia, one from Croatia, who wanted to be a little dictators in their own yard. So while you guys were tearing the Berlin Wall down, we were figuring out how to build more walls and more fences. And of course, we did it through the four civil wars. So without further ado, you had two choices when faced with that. And I'm sure that this is a very similar thing that you're experiencing in your generation when it comes to climate change. When the things go south, or from bad to worse, the young person has two choices. You can fight or you can flee. So we decided to stay and fight, build up the movement in early 90s, build that movement and learn through the mistakes. It was a long struggle. Through mid and late 90s, 1998, we formed a movement called Otpor, which is the Serbian word for resistance, which grew from 11 people to around 20,000 daily active people in 2000, and was capable to exercise a strategy. Strategy was basically unite the opposition, control the ballot boxes, get as many as possible young people involved in both activism and voting, and then make sure that when Milosevic loses elections and says that he didn't lose elections, country goes to general strike and persuade him to succeed.
That sounds very impressive, and I saw on your website, on Canvas's website, that you have advised activists in more than 50 countries. If you are now looking back at all this movement building work that you have done, what would you say? What are the most important lessons that you have learned?
Movements are different, and situations are different, and goals are different, and scale is different. Sometimes you're working with the people who are trying to defend a piece of forest. Sometimes you're working with the people who are trying to overthrow oppressive government. Sometimes you're working with people who are addressing the systemic racism. Whatever the scale or the nature or the environment is, the principles of success of these movements are all the same. in order to succeed, movements need to have vision and unity. And that means that they need to know where they are going instead of just saying, oh, we are anti-fossil fuel. Second part of this unity means that movements need to figure out that the way that the success is built is through numbers. And most of the numbers on whatever given issue in the world you're looking at are in the middle of the political and social spectrum. So not too many people are too religious or too atheistic, not too many people are too much pro this or too much pro that. Most of the people are in the middle. So how to move your struggle in the middle, how to tackle the things that people can touch and feel, and how to mobilize these people towards the movement is the most important part of this. Second very important principle is the principle of planning. There are only two types of movements in this world, historically looking. There are spontaneous movements and successful movements. In order to be successful, movements need to plan things. They need to plan their general strategy. They need to plan the institutions they target, which we call pillars of support, and how to pull these pillars. And then they need to plan individual campaigns for each of these pillars or each of their goals. And then they need to plan the tactics. Too often, movements get it upside down. They get involved in tactics before they are building the strategy. And then when you talk to them, you have this marvelous answer, oh, we don't have time for planning. We're too busy doing it. And this is a really important issue, and this is a really important point. You need to plan, and you need to have a plan. And people in the movement need to know what the plan is and what their role in the plan is, and what are they doing, when they are doing it, and why they are doing it. The more they know, the more they can contribute. Last but not of least importance, history teaches us that nonviolent movements are twice more likely to succeed than the violent movements. So not only that nonviolence is morally superior to the violence, it is also a grand lesson in history that one single act of violence can diminish the numbers and the reputation of your movement and justify your opponent's oppression against it. So yes, vision and unity, planning and strategy, and nonviolent discipline are these three things which you can distill, which connects all the successful movements, large and small, worldwide.
Just for our listeners who maybe are not so, haven't kind of read any of your books or haven't been on the website, maybe you can, you mentioned the pillars of support that you need to analyze and then develop tactics to attack. Maybe you can just line out for like a short moment what these pillars of support are and what their function is.
Well, whether you're looking at the Chemosopedia website, which has a lot of free stuff on it, whether you buy the book, which is called The Blueprint for Revolution, but for some weird reasons, it was published under the name Protest in Germany. It has not much to do with protest, but, you know, publisher thought it was a good idea. You will figure out the structure of this thinking. This theory of change starts with an idea that if people do not obey, rulers cannot rule. And if the people demand change, the status quo is unsustainable. And then the second part of it comes that, yes, people hold power, but the power is exercised. It is happening through institutions and organizations. And mapping these institutions and organizations along the way is what you call the pillars of support. So imagine the building, and this building is standing on the different walls, but in order to, you know, bring this building down, bring the building of oppression down, bring the building of what Obama called the tyranny of oil down, you're not tearing the building down. You're looking at the most important pillars of the building. So what may be the most important institutions that are connected to the change that you want to achieve? How to identify these institutions, how to rank them in terms of which institutions are more accessible to you. E.g., you fight for democracy, you would normally start with a group of urban educated students that are looking outwards, and then you will spread this towards their parents, and then from cities to villages and things of that kind. So which pillars are more accessible and which pillars are more important? That gives you a very good answer to the question what your strategy may be. Your strategy may be the shortest causal chain between you and swaying most important pillars. How do you do it? is swaying the pillars, which are more accessible first. So it also gives you a timeline, or what we call the order of battle. Yes, we need to tackle the question of climate change in Germany, but we will start with the three most polluting mines in the country first. So it's like, you know, it's like I'm not saying this should be your strategy. I'm just telling you how the structural thinking gets you to it. And yes, we need to persuade the majority of people in this country that the climate change is imminent and terminal, and it's impacting all of us. But instead of starting with climate change deniers who are reading QAnon crap, we'll start with the people who are already aware of it. We'll take a look at the strongholds. We'll take a look at how to mobilize the younger generation, which is obviously more environmentally concerned. Then we will, you know, turn our gaze to businesses and figure out that, for example, green economies are now employing, even in the United States, far more people than the fossil fuel economies. So in order to persuade the people for whom the climate change is some intangible conspiracy, you start talking about jobs, you start talking about income, you start talking about economy of climate change and how you can shift this towards the greener world, how it actually pays off. And then also looking at the timeline, you want to look at the momentum. Most of the movements, as well as most of the policies, are triggered by the events. And speaking of Germany and climate change, there was a long battle to take a look at what shall we do with nuclear energy. And then the Fukushima happened. And in the rage of a few months, you have the public swaying from one way of thinking to another. You have the right-wing government swaying their policy from one way of thinking to another. So you need to predict these triggers and have the strategies in place to exploit these triggers.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you have to actually have like the strategy ready for when the event hits, and then you can just roll it all out and be ready for it. And which is also maybe like a good point for why it is so important to invest in movement building, even in times when the window of opportunity is not widely open, because then when it opens again, you are there and you can act, you can mobilize, and you can actually then trigger the success that you want to see. But we will come back to that later, I guess. One thing that I find really interesting in your work, Sirja, is that nonviolence is very often discussed more like as a philosophy or as an ethic. But in your work, you think of it more as a strategy and as a tactic towards political success. Can you maybe briefly explain why you think this distinction between the philosophical part of it and the tactical part of it is so important?
Absolutely. First of all, let us distinguish the terminology nonviolence versus nonviolence. Nonviolent discipline. Nonviolence is something that you can take a look as the attitude, the philosophy, the religion, the feeling, the value, if you want. Nonviolent discipline is a skill. And as any other skill, as driving a car or, you know, skiing, it can be learned, and you can educate people how to do this kind of stuff. Well, nobody ever taught me properly how to ride a ski, so that's probably a bad comparison. But I learned how to ride a car. So taking a look into nonviolent discipline, you want to take a look at two different aspects of it. One is, of course, the common sense aspect. Another one is history and science. I'll start with history and science first. History teaches us, and there are numerous studies, most popular one being Why Civil Resistance Works, a book by Maria Stefan and Erika Chenoweth, published in 2008, with a great addition of a data set that they built over the course of the last 12 years. Basically, they were looking at hundreds of different campaigns throughout the last century or so, and they were measuring their success and the level to which they achieved their goals. And they were comparing this to whether the struggle was predominantly violent or predominantly nonviolent, or it was a nonviolent struggle with a violent flank, if you want. So, you know, it's like you have this sabotage ideas in the South African movement against apartheid, which is why Nelson Mandela sat on a Robben Island for so long. Taking a look at the data set of over, I think now it's 450 campaigns. I didn't check lately, but it was over 400. They gave you the clear proof that the nonviolent campaigns are twice more likely to succeed than the violent campaigns. Why so? Because that for the change in the community, especially the long-term change in community, you need a certain level of participation. And there is a direct connection between number of the people participating in a certain campaign and the possibility of this campaign to succeed. So more the people participate in the campaign, and they were looking at different numbers. Some societies it's 3%, some societies it's 8%, but let's say up to 10%. You need up to 8% of the daily active people in a certain community in order to achieve this threshold of 50%. So basically, to get out of the numbers, this study teaches us that nonviolence is more effective than violence, A, twice more effective, B, it is because the people are more likely to participate in the campaigns which don't involve throwing stones at the police, burning cars, destroying property, or throwing Molotovs, and that's just the common sense. And then second, also the type of the people you can recruit for a nonviolent campaign, which involves, you know, banging pots and pans from the windows, or, you know, writing a petition or boycotting a certain company because of its policies, that can involve a variety and diversity of different people, where by age, by education, by income, by race, by ethnicity, by religion, as opposed to the guerrilla movement, where you're actually limited to this very small portion of society, which is ready to, you know, kill and die for what they believe for, has some kind of military training, is ready to camp in the woods. So basically, your recruitment base is far wider, which leads you to the wider participation.
What I gathered is, so you can look at there's a philosophical level of nonviolence, but there are also the tactics that you need the numbers, and you don't get the numbers if you're more violent or if you kind of escalate the action level, because then people, not everybody can come, elderly people can come, people that may be disabled can come. So that's kind of the tactical level, if I like press it down to a very, very like short sentence. That's kind of also the tactical level about it. Yeah. However, like we already said that in the climate movement in Germany, currently there is a discussion about escalation. And I think it's mainly because kind of Fridays for Future had these mass organizations, and then there was this mass demonstration to which 1.4 million people came all over Germany. It was the largest demonstration that ever happened in Germany. And then nothing happened. So politics just didn't meet the demands, and they stayed way behind even what everybody thought was possible in the movement.
And despite the numbers.
And despite the numbers of people. And so naturally now people are thinking, what else are we supposed to do? And maybe escalation would be a good idea, because then we make the kind of pressing situation of the climate crisis more clear to more people. And what would you say, what should the movement do, or what can you do if you're at the peak of the movement, but then politics don't meet the demands?
Contemporary movements are very different animals than the movements in the past, where you had a central group that has a demand and is capable to mobilize the larger portions of society, mostly by making coalitions with like-minded group and then expanding these coalitions across the board. You want to take a look at the workers' rights, suffragette movement, racial inequality movement, all these kind of movements, LGBTQ movement. All these movements were built in a very traditional way. Group, organization, coalition, strategy, spreading coalition, and then taking a look at the institutions, where protesting institutions or lobbying institutions or going for elections and conquering the institutions from inside. It's a very, very 20th century model, if you want, of a political movement. 21st century model takes a look at a very dispersed, a very spread, very fastly spread social movements. We can discuss how big role the social media had in it, positive and negative. But basically, the movements of 2020s are the movements that are built around the triggers. Mostly, if you take a look at BLM, it's a great example of how one viral video can spark a nationwide movement. And only then organizations cope with it. So it's a very different outbreak philosophy. Because they are not run by organizations, these movements are very fast to spread and very fast to bring people from different walks of life. Also, that it gives, which is very important, the big ownership over movement to the local groups. So FFF is a great example where people are encouraged to act locally. They're encouraged to join the thing locally and not too many things. There is no powerful Cominterna type of central committee where everything is decided and then exercised top bottom. So these are the good news. The bad news that in this type of decentralized movement, it's very difficult to build a common strategy, and it's very difficult to build a small victory path to it, because successful movements depend on small victories. And because successful movements need to understand the small victories, and because the successful movements need to celebrate the small victories. So the way your question was structured was, oh, we brought 1 million people on the street and we didn't achieve it, so what? Well, what about having Greens in the government after having years of right-wing government with AfD growing a few years ago? Are you aware of how much you achieved? What about having the worldwide movement, which is making high school kids leaving high schools on Fridays? What was there 5 years ago? Nothing. There were bulk of outdated international organizational giants. But instead of that, no foot on the ground. So there are amazing things this movement achieved, and there are also battles that it lost.
I think one thought that came to my mind when you were talking is that the struggle against climate change is actually a little bit different from earlier social movements, where it was a lot easier to celebrate small victories because you knew you were like marching in the right direction, and inch by inch you could get like the women's right to vote or worker protection or the 8 hours day or all these like reforms that improved the lives of people bit by bit. But with climate change, you know, if you have the Greens in parliament or in the on government, but the policies that they decide are not enough to bring Germany on the path for 1.5 degrees, then it's still shit, because like climate change gets worse every day. So how would you respond to that? How can you uphold this mindset of celebrating small victories when at the same time the crisis is escalating instead of like being beaten?
Yeah, but I mean, it's like the thing is like you are doing something and you are not doing enough, but you can also take a look at who else is doing nothing and how to impact those who are doing nothing. And that brings these two worlds very close. And this is something that I very often find climate change activists not aware of or not interested enough of, and I would like to have them more interested of, which is a very big part of the opposition to the climate change movement. It has nothing to do with climate change, has nothing to do with Greens and SPDs and whoever rules the Germany. It has a lot to do with dictators. There is a direct correlation between the level to which your country depends on fossil fuels and commodities and the level of democracy. And that thing tells you that the only democracy that survived oil was Norway. Mm-hmm. And that was only because they discovered oil 60 years after they discovered democracy. Okay, take a look at the sources of evil. Take a look at the worst of the worst in the World Democracy Index. You would be looking at the places like Russia, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. Take a look at the largest decreases in Venezuela. Take a look at the largest decreases in democracy across the globe. You will figure out that Nigeria was far more democratic before it discovered oil. Mm-hmm. So now you're looking in a very, very interesting game. And by the way, take a look at what will happen to you if you demonstrate climate change in Moscow. So if you want to take a look at this struggle globally, it is very important to look at the multi-layer system. By getting world rid of dependency on fossil fuels, you're also fighting an uphill struggle against the growing grip of dictators whose power depend on fossil fuel. Some of them are buying off your politician. You know, the guy like Gerhard Schroeder, mm-hmm. Gazprom, you know that story, beautiful story. Let's buy off a German chancellor when he retires. Buy the money coming from fossil fuels from autocratic country. So taking a look at this global aspect of it takes a very different view. And what I really love with organizations like FFF is that they are really looking at how to coordinate this campaign. So how do you look at a bank in Britain or in Germany which funds the crap that is grabbing land or destroying lives of the people in the Philippines? So how do you combine this thing that is happening in the global north, in the global south? And I know that doesn't answer your question, but you know, it's like my world is very different from what the Greens will propose in German parliament. I don't read it, I don't care for it. This is not where I live. I'm living in a place where the friends of mine that I trained get arrested from protesting forest fires in Brazil. So it's like when you take a look at where it really happens, where the rubber hits the road, you will figure out that you need to combine what you're trying to do. If your enemy is global, you need to engage that enemy on a global level. Mm-hmm. And once again, enemy is not the climate change. Enemy are greedy companies funded by even greedier banks. Then the companies and banks put in their pocket the politicians, and then they go to the bad, the worst dictators in the globe, because this is where the real rubber hits the mm-hmm. road. So taking a look at how you take on these things, and FFF, for example, had several very effective campaigns which were targeting the financial institutions in the north that are funding crap in the global south. And I think this is you need to take a look at the bigger picture. And when you are taking a look at the bigger picture, then once again, your question is very different. So which German institutions are contributing to the shit which is happening in Philippines, and how to make this institution responsible? Mm-hmm. You need to take a look out of your blurb and say, how we make Germany decrease 0.03 points, and then we don't have 350 ppm spare whatsoever. Even the language of environmental movement is ununderstandable for me. You need to find a different language. You're talking to the person who feels passionately about environmental movements, and I have an MA in biology. So that means I probably did 4 or 5 exams on ecology. I don't fucking understand what the 350 ppm per something else means. How do you expect the farmer in Colorado Springs who loves Trump and thinks that climate change is a Chinese hoax to understand this?
Hey, sorry für die kurze Unterbrechung. Du hörst den Was tun Podcast. Und falls dir gefällt, was du hörst, dann haben wir eine ganz kurze Bitte an dich. Nimm dir jetzt eine Sekunde Zeit und lass uns eine Bewertung da. Klick einfach auf die 5 Sterne und damit hilfst du uns ungemein dabei, mit unserem Podcast noch mehr Menschen zu erreichen. Also, jetzt bewerten und dann viel Spaß beim Weiterhören.
What I find really interesting about what you said about autocratic regimes and dictatorships and their connection to fossil fuel energy is that it just resonated with me that in the earlier movement in Germany, when they were talking about building up renewable energy in Germany, they were doing it with Genossenschaften, which is, I think, translated into cooperatives. And they were also always talking about kind of democratizing the energy system, because if you build up renewable energies, you kind of distribute the whole power of the national power grid, which is like the most valuable infrastructure a country has right now among the people and among different people. And you also create different islands of energy infrastructure that can't be controlled by the government anymore. So it just resonated with me. It seems to make a lot of sense.
Welcome to Colorado, where you can invest money, get your house solar for the next 20 years. We have a lot of sun here, and then get completely off grid.
Yep.
It's exactly what you're talking about. So this is empowering people.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also, I mean, I think the system that they initially built in Germany with the cooperatives was also very, very smart and really cool, because it was working with also a lot of wind turbines, which were then owned by normal people who had an interest in energy transition by getting the revenue off that. But
yeah, but if I can interrupt this, I would also talk about this democracy on a very blunt level. Coming from Serbia, country which slides towards autocracy under the Vučić government for years, taking a look at the most promising protests in the recent Serbian history, which happened recently, mobilizing the wide spectrum of population, thousands of people to block the roads daily, sometimes being cleaned up by the police, sometimes being attacked by the regime thugs, in order to prevent Rio Tinto to build a lithium mine in Serbia. Where are the damn support demonstrations in Germany to support this type of movement in Serbia? It's not Philippines, you know, it's what, 1 hour and 1.5 hour flight between Belgrade and Munich. And what is the role of German government, which is one of the largest lithium importers in it? So they will actually love this mine. Previous government, this government, any kind of German government. So now take a look at your yard. I don't want you to take a look at how the, you know, movement against the right-wing, cynical, business-friendly grub burned the Amazon forest in Brazil, or the movement around the let's empower and buy off ethnic wars in very lefty Bolivia. So these two combined produce the largest forest fires in Amazon. And that happened a few years ago and sparked the movements which took half of the support from Bolsonaro and took Morales down from power. I'm not saying take a look at the Bolivia. Bolivia is far away. Take a look at the Serbia. Mm-hmm. So what can you do to empower each other in these countries, especially when you clearly see that this type of environmental movements is the big threat to corrupt and autocratically leaning governments? That's the byproduct I'm interested in. But the byproduct the environmentalists should be interested in is a kind of solidarity. I love seeing Greta Thunberg today being with indigenous people and defending their lands against the mine. Mm-hmm. You guys need to support each other. Because, you know, if people do something, and especially if that something is risky, and taking a charge on the government in a place like Serbia is riskier than in Germany, taking a charge against the government on environment in a place like Philippines can kill you. It's one of the deadliest countries in the world for environmental activists. It's really dangerous being an environmental activist there. So what can you do to use the power you have, and the fact you have representation in the parliament, you have representation in the government, and you have representation in a European parliament, how you can shake the institutions you already can influence to support this movements, rather than thinking, oh, the policies of Greens in Germany. It's this, like, I'm looking into my own house and I'm gonna be a shit what is happening elsewhere.
Yeah, very interesting. So maybe this also means to, because like in the last 2 years, I would say the main focus point was really towards like changing the majorities within the election. And now we have to reorientate a little bit and say, well, now we're not always like only like talking to the government and looking at the policies they produce, but also reshifting towards supply chains and see the connections internationally to then politicize that, creating maybe like image damage for companies, but also then bringing governments to divest, bringing governments to withdraw money from whatever, or end any contracts or something like this. That could be like a reorientation process that you are suggesting here, right? But one argument or one thesis from your book that I found very interesting, which is also a little bit tied into the conversation that we are having right now, is the question of like,
movements collapsing at their greatest peak. You said that, or you're writing in your book that the majority of movement collapses when they're actually very strong. Could you elaborate a little bit further on this and say maybe also something what we can learn about what we can learn from failed movements?
Well, I mean, basically the movements fail for different reasons, and some of them fail in the launching phase, some of them fail in engagement phase, some of them just take the wrong strategies. But surprisingly, historically, most of the movements are capable of mobilizing large numbers. It is how they capitalize and institutionalize the victory where the real failure lies. So yes, you can make a change, and where you're looking at a small thing like, you know, the XR and once again the amazing movement with very interesting tactics emerging in Britain and getting the short-term goal of making the British Parliament proclaiming the climate crisis or climate emergency, and then what? How this is followed up by the certain politics. So the thing is, like, when you look at the goal, and especially when you're looking at the wider goal of changing the long-term policy of the country on something very complex like climate change or education or whatever, you need to look at the marathon level of it. And on the marathon level of it, you will need to get to the point where you will have people to fill in the places, people to participate in policies, people, like, you know, it's not only about being on the street and making corrupt prime minister resign and then go home. And then, of course, the ruling party elects another corrupt prime minister. What a surprise. And then people say, oh, we were protesting for nothing. So you're not looking into the one-term goals, one-term victories. These are very important. But in order to avoid this failure, you need to figure out that this is the marathon. It is the institutions you want to change. You need to have policies in place. Great if you have the white coalition with the bulk of people. Environmental movement is a great family of amazing people with amazing skills, from protesting and campaigning to coming out with policy, being in a happy marriage with a lot of scientists, being in a happy marriage, and that marriage needs to be stronger and happier with the green-leaning companies. There's this pretty puritanistic approach that, you know, it's a big business and we are kind of too lefty to be in a bed with a big business, but your goals are aligned with a green business. You will need to cooperate with a green business. And if that means green business raising money for more progressive candidates and the movement endorsing it, then yes. Don't be blindsided by the fact that by being green, you are also leftist, so you are against the corporations. Like, leave this ideology for later and make sure you tackle the urgent things first. So taking a look into this point, I think you need to take a look to the successful examples and overarching victories of stuff, but you need to understand that inevitably movements need lose numbers when they get too close to the victory. So the way you're structuring your struggle is also how you're structuring these victories and what you're telling people to do. And, you know, it's like you may mobilize a lot of people on a trigger. There is a pollution, there is Fukushima, let's close the nukes. There is an oil leak, let's go after Chevron or whoever make this mess. There is a certain mine that we need to close. There is a big corruption exposed in Volkswagen, so let's go after these people. So when you're building around these triggers, you need to have in mind that what you aim is not just to punish or put a price tag on a certain behavior. It is to replace certain behavior and certain policies with a different behavior and a different policies. And that takes time and strategy and fight through the institutions. This is where a lot of people leave. You know, I had this experience in Serbia. It's like it was so much easier to mobilize the people to risk their lives and jobs and families and getting arrested and beaten on the streets before 2000 than it was persuading people to get inside the institution and replace the bad Milosevic bureaucrats after the change. That's just not sexy enough. Mm-hmm. People tend to get engaged in topics and they tend to invest themselves in their money and their time. And then somehow magically, they don't think that they are the people who carry the change. Then they leave the show and leave it to the same people who screw the thing to start with.
Mm-hmm. Also, this is where the fighting starts, right? When you are at the point of success and certainly you realize that the group is way more heterogeneous than when you had the strong enemy and you were still...
Absolutely. It's where you lose unity. Enemy is enemy or threat. The common threat is what unites people. It has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with you know, us as a Homo sapiens. Being human, and you know, it's like probably millions of years ago, we were living in caves, and even within the cave life, we would have our arguments, like, you know, where are we going to hunt tomorrow? Who is going to marry the hairy beauty of the tribe, or whatever? Where our struggles? But then immediately there is a bear in front of the cave, so we figure out how to cooperate till we get rid of bear, and once the bear is out, we can continue fighting. Again, so having the powerful enemy, and especially in the world of where your enemy is a tangible bad guy, is an evil corrupt official, it's a powerful autocratic government, or it's a large ugly corrupt corporation like Nestle selling their shit from their milk formula in order to increase the profit. When you have an enemy like this, it's really easy to unify the left-wing environmental extremists with the people preaching equality and health for children in the right-wing churches. So you can create a really wide coalition, and actually the more your enemy escalates, the more he's likely to boost this unity. The more he starts labeling you as a traitor, the more he starts arresting people, the more he starts denying funds, the more your opponent is helping your unity by arresting 2,500 people in a final campaign in Serbia. 700 of them were arrested in the high schools. So Milosevic was sending police to high schools to arrest high school kids because they were wearing the movement's t-shirt. How do you think it impacted our membership? It quadruplied our membership. It boosted our membership to the cosmic level. Because what would happen that all the kids in that school would come tomorrow to our offices to have the same t-shirts, and all the parents would be listed for our stands and door-to-door campaigns to spread leaflets. So by doing this, your opponent is actually boosting your numbers. It's boosting your unity. People who are very different among themselves see the common threat. And of course, they see their differences as not important or not that urgent at the moment. And they unite to get rid of the common threat. Once again, as you said in the question, once the common threat is not there, this is where the devil pops its ugly head of disunity.
I think kind of that's also... like bringing it back to the German climate movement a little bit where we are right now, because we got rid of the CDU and the government, who were the bad guys who were stopping all and blockading all climate action. And now the Greens are in government, and actually what they wrote in the coalition treaty is way not enough. Kind of the, mainly the Social Democrats and the liberals whom they're in a coalition with, put most of the, like by far most of the effective climate action out. And so now I would say we're like in the movement at a point where a lot of the population thinks, oh, the Greens are in government, everything will be fine. And the people in the movement think, wow, look at what they're actually doing. This is by far not enough, and it's not sufficient, and we need to do things. And I think that's kind of this frustration in a way, but also the disparity between what climate activists think and what the general population think makes poses a pretty big problem for the movement, because it's very hard to reach the big numbers. And I think that's also where the discussion on sabotage stems from, that we talked about or mentioned earlier, that people are thinking like, what means do we need to employ now to raise awareness among the population that the Greens in government won't solve the problem?
But again, I need to criticize that typically environmental movement language, raising awareness is good. Giving people call to action is what really works. So instead of what we need to do to raise awareness is what is the action that we can invite people to do against officials, companies, for policies, for support of green business, or on international level. I understand why you think structurally and the way you think it should be thinking structurally, but also you should be thinking out of the box if you want to mobilize people to do something instead of just making them aware.
Yeah, talking about calls to action, maybe it is also a problem in the German movement that the actions that activists are actually participating in are somehow ritualized, a little bit boring, you know, just like demonstrating on every Friday after 2 years gets a little bit odd maybe. And also the media attention for it decreases a lot because it's no interesting story anymore. And this is also one aspect of your work that I really, really admire, that you talk a lot about humor in activism, what you call laughtivism. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about it and also give some examples of how to think more out of the box to create interesting movement stories for the media, but also fun things to do for activists to fight for their causes in a maybe like more fun way?
Well, first of all, it started as something we were doing in Serbia, and then started figuring out that actually movement, and specifically the concept that we call dilemma actions, is very successful and it works worldwide. A little research we've done last year as a part of our Global Medal Award for Democracy. And we did 40 cases in a small book called Pranksters versus Autocrats, Why Dilemma Actions Advance Nonviolent Activism. The book I co-wrote with one of the world's largest experts on satire and then comedy shows, Sophia McLennan of Penn State University. And now we are expanding it with the work, research work of people from UVA and Canvas, and we are around 200 cases now. We are looking at the cases where dilemma and humor were facing the change, and we figure out that it has outsized effect on so many different aspects of the movement. First, using dilemma actions and humor is more likely to draw more members to your movement. It's more likely to be replicated because people really like it, especially if they can get away with it. It's more likely to gain international media attention. If you do a protest in a small place in Russia and 50 people come in and then the police come and cleans them out, maybe somebody will tape it on a camera, people will share it on Twitter, and that's the end. If, however, you make a toy protest in Russia, which happened in 2012, and then everybody is there taping, and then the Kremlin sees it and sees it as a threat because it's non-threatening with a little toys carrying transparency for free and fair elections. But you know, you have this dilemma whether you leave this go, but too many people have seen it, so they will start replicating it, and we'll have a little pandemic of the toy protests. And or you want to crush it and, you know, basically get into the history as the person who banned toy protests, which happened, and then you order for toy protests to be banned, and then this shit ended up on a cover page of three large mainstream European newspapers, one of which is Guardian. Then you look at the effect of the creativity and a dilemma situation. So taking a look at how you strategically plan your tactics, how you put your opponent in dilemma, a large chunk of this is environment. Huge chunk of this research is how stunts were used in the environmental movements. One of my favorite things was the group called Yes Man. In they do a lot of these what we call the stunt statements. So what they will do, there was this big Volkswagen scandal and where they were lying about the emissions and they didn't really want to apologize and what the fuck they will do, where they will pull the cars, where they will give people money back, all of this thing a few years ago. And here comes this small collective from New York run by a friend of mine, amazing guy, that came out with a fake press release. So here are the Yes Men, but they look like Volkswagen. and they're sending everybody a press release from a Volkswagen's email address saying how deeply concerned Volkswagen is for this crisis and how deeply the leadership of Volkswagen apologizes to this crisis. And now if you are a leadership of Volkswagen and you're looking this thing trending in the media, the thing that you never sent and never signed but cannot deny, what the heck will you do? A, you can come out and say, oh, this is fake. In fact, we do not apologize. Or you can apologize and grant this small group of creative pranksters the victory. So this is where we are talking about the use of dilemma and use of humor. It's not only mocking your opponent. Mocking your opponent, it's only one part of it. But strategically putting your opponent in a dilemma framework where if they react, they look stupid. If they don't, they look weak. So this is really interesting aspect. And once again, pranksters versus autocrats. If you speak English, it's free of charge on Amazon. You can download it as a free ebook. And it gives all of these anecdotes and stories about how loftivism and dilemma actions were used. And it has 40 different cases. And 6 or 7 of them are related to environment. Mm-hmm. And there is a growing cluster we are looking at that how these stunts are used in environmental struggle.
But how do you draft a dilemma action? I mean, I think the example you posed with the press release is kind of makes a lot of sense to me, and I kind of can imagine how it works. But how do you find
these situations? You need to spend some 40 minutes reading the book because it has a detailed blueprint for how you design dilemma action. Actually, you don't start with designing dilemma action. You're looking at the something in the world of dilemma action, which is called a widely held belief. So, okay, widely held belief is people should be free to meet in public, but because the law in Belarus is preventing them from meeting in public, more than 5 of them are considered to be the political rally and needs to be reported to the police. Then the people in Belarus will bring 6, 7, 8, 9, a little bit more than 5 people coming on the central square of Belarus and do something ridiculous. Like they would be going around and reading loud the Belarusian constitution. So this is the framework, starts with a widely held belief. And then you design the action, people mm-hmm. coming to feed pigeons or people coming to read the constitution, but 6 people, not 5 people. So now you put your opponent in a dilemma, whether they will let you break their ban on 5 people and appear to be weak, or they will really be there arresting people because they're reading the state's constitution loud and look like idiots. So this is how but you start with a widely held belief. You mm-hmm. don't start with the action. So mm-hmm. take a look at what is this thing which will tackle people, which people consider normal, and where is the largest gap between normal and what is the government policy? You're mm-hmm. looking at these type of beliefs. Sometimes it's, you know, it is something which comes clearly out of your mind. Sometimes it comes from the bottom of your butt. Like, you know, everywhere in the world, men and women should be driving. Everywhere in the world, if a woman has a car, she can drive their kids to school, except in Saudi Arabia, which is why we need a campaign that will teach women how to drive in Saudi Arabia, because it's considered to be non-kosher there. So you're looking at what may be the widely held belief, even in a very oppressive society, and then you design the action which fits this big gap between what the policy is and what people really consider to be mm-hmm. normal. The reason why well-designed dilemma action, or the favorite dilemma action of Yes Man, which is the fake press release, works is because people think that if company makes shit, they should be apologizing and giving people money back. This is why the tactic works. Mm-hmm. The tactic is not working because it's brilliantly designed, but because the Yes Men understand that this is something they should be tackling, and this is what is called the widely held belief. So whenever you see the well-exercised dilemma action, it starts with people who design it mm-hmm. by understanding what is the widely held belief. Mm-hmm. People should have right to protest in Russia. If people cannot protest in Russia, we will bring the toys. no police in the world will arrest toys. That's a widely held belief. It's a common sense. Mm-hmm. And you're doing it because you know that Putin will come to arrest the toys. He arrested the damn snowman a few months ago.
So somehow you exploit the absurdity of reality, right? You somehow feed into the expectation of people. So it should be absolutely normal to read the Constitution in public, but because
it should be absolutely normal to gather in public to start with.
Yeah.
And if we cannot gather in public, let's check if we can gather in public and read the Constitution.
Yes, exactly.
And then if we get arrested, which we expect to happen and boost our stunt even more, very often it is the response to your opponent that actually fuels the mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. Because then they show even more of the ridiculousness of it. So you have this red and white flags as a symbol of the opposition in Belarus. You have Lukashenko who is chasing people who are wearing red and white flags. And next thing you know, it's Christmas. And due to the widely held belief that people can decorate their Christmas trees whichever way they like, and also due to the fact that for, well, some say for Coca-Cola branding, but we all know Santa Claus is red and white. That's the problem for Lukashenko. Now you have the Christmas trees in Belarusian neighborhoods decorated in the color of red and white. And of course, it freaks Lukashenko because it brands neighborhoods as the opposition to his eternal rule. And he sends the special police to bring down the decoration from the Christmas trees. Now, who looks like an idiot? But once again, it starts with widely held belief. People are decorating mm-hmm. their trees for Christmas and people could decorate them the way they want to decorate them. And by the way, red and white is pretty common color. Mm-hmm. So the reason why this works is because you're putting your opponent, you're treating your opponent as a part of theater. Mm-hmm. So you're doing it with knowing police will come. Mm-hmm. And you know exactly know how the photos of the special police force bringing down decorations from Christmas tree because they are red and white will look to your neighbors or will look to somebody in Germany if Deutsche Welle reports on it. Do you look like, wow, this guy's crazy? I mean, how else?
Right. Like, it also makes me think actually in the environmental area of an action that people did in the beginning of Corona crisis, when like going on bikes was a huge thing in Germany, also because in many countries, I think, because also people were saying, well, you don't use public transport and you kind of reduce contacts by going on bikes. And then people printed like at the during nighttime, they painted bigger bike lanes on the street. And it also played into the kind of feeling at the time that there were like places in Berlin and other cities that were really, really dangerous for people on bikes or where they had really bad or small bike lanes. And so it kind of played into the belief and feeling of people that there needed to be more lanes. And then actually the Berlin government also put up more pop-up bike lanes.
So because it was like the dilemma was like either the authorities would go and put the bike lanes away, even though they always promise to bring more bike lanes. Oh, there's the dilemma. So that would be a good example.
It's a very good one. I'm going to take a look. If you send me a link, I'll put it in the
Yeah, look at
it's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But reason why it works is because people believe mm-hmm. that bikers should have safe lanes and mm-hmm. government promise to deliver the safe lanes. And then whatever you do along these lines puts your opponent in a very bad position because the belief is already there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think one more aspect of it, which is very interesting, we talked a lot about the importance of numbers earlier, but in these kind of actions, you don't even need that great number to have like a big impact and to create mm-hmm. a big resonance. You can actually take your like five comrades from your activist group and if you have a good idea, you can do it and that will create pressure on politicians to act.
Listen, if you take a look at only one cluster that we are exploring, that's a cluster of the potholes. People found 17 different very creative ways to create dilemma actions about city governments not being capable to deal with the potholes. From painting a mayor's face around the pothole in Yekaterinburg, Russia in 2015. So when you hit the pothole with a car, you actually have a person to curse because it's his face. around the pothole, all the way to planting flowers and trees and celebrating birthdays of a pothole in Brazil, or putting the water in a pothole in Canada and then, you know, stocking the pond with a fish because it's a very big pothole. People found a very creative way to do it. Once again, you don't need a large number. Well, the power of dilemma actions is that once again, our research shows that it has outsized effect. So you get a large turnout in terms of media attention, sometimes in the case of Berlin and bike lanes, the government response or concessions, if you want, the victories. And you don't need to engage a lot of people because you're strategically exploiting the widely held belief with a strategically designed tactic, and you don't necessarily need thousands of people. So it's a, once again, it's like the we go back to the theory of planning and strategy. Part of planning, and especially tactical planning, is how you get the most for the investment. If you want a march of 10,000 people, which lasts for 2 hours, you calculate it and break it down and say, this is 10,000 people times 2 hours, so 20,000 working hours. It's probably 5,000 working hours more in preparing this show, printing posters, leaflets, Facebook events, whatever we advertise it. Then we need to invest some money in it because for 20,000 people, we need transparency and loudspeakers and t-shirts. Like, you make this cost assessment. When you take a look at this cost before you get engaged in another march, you just ask yourself, okay, if I have everything to all of this to invest, what else can I achieve with this type of investment? And this is where the real creative thinking on tactics begins, figuring out that tactics have cost and effect. And what you really want when you're strategically planning tactics is to maximize the effect and minimize the cost, where the cost is number of people or there or the time they spend, or this is the cost of money. And this is exactly what we are talking about. You know, advertising against the mayor in the newspaper would cost million times more and produce far less effect than painting the face of a mayor around 30 potholes, which probably costs, I don't know, what, like three of us can fundraise for this. All we need is somebody who really know how to do it. I don't know how to draw. It's like when you take a look at the investment and paint and speed of action and the way it can spread over social media is something that five people can exercise swiftly.
Sirja, in our talk and in the interview, we had a lot of very hands-on examples, strategies, tactics that can really be applied in activists' lives day to day, I think. And we also already mentioned the website of Canvas. All the listeners can download lots of material online. But as I know that Canvas is also providing actual training to activists, I thought it might be interesting to ask you whether and if yes, how activists who listen to the podcast and got interested in maybe getting a training can get into touch and learn from you also very practically.
Yeah, we do a lot of different stuff for various activists. We have workshops and presentations and free educational videos. We have different kind of educational tools. We do a lot of things in person. We do a lot of things over Zoom. There is a detailed curriculum of different topics, which you can find on our website. The best way to contact us is once again through the website. There is a special page where you can kind of write a request and things of that kind. Basically, we work a lot with the different groups. We are very small, so our resources are pretty stretched, but don't hesitate to contact us if you think we can help.
Great. Thank you. It was very, very interesting talking to you. I learned a lot, and I think many of the listeners have also learned a lot.
Yes. Thank you very much for the interesting conversation and all of your insights.
Thank you. Keep up the good work. And sorry if I sound like I'm criticizing it. I'm your work. It was more like, you know, trying to help you. And because I'm you know, spending a lot of time working with people, I learned that sometimes they may feel unpleasant where you tell them where their failures are, but it's actually the most useful part of the conversation very often.
Definitely.
Yep.
So sorry if I sounded critical. Once again, just to stray that point, I strongly admire what the environmental movement, and specifically what the environmental movement in Germany, is doing. So just don't get me wrong.
Thank you. That's very, very nice to hear. And I think a lot of the listeners will also be very happy to hear that.
Yeah. But I think also like the point in talking strategy is really also like disagreeing, discussing, really like not being in this harmonious la 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 where you can also like just say yes to everything the other one says, because you cannot do everything at the same time. And that's the hard choices you have to make.
Yes.
Okay. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye,
you
too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Das war der Was tun Podcast. Konzept und Redaktion Valentin Isen und Inken Bermann. Schnitt Julian Schwumberger. Die Musik kommt von Richard Waterman.